And it is a great pleasure to welcome back to the program for yet another visit, probably the seventh or eighth over the long years that we've been doing this thing, Alan M. Dershowitz. Good evening, sir.
Hi, thank you so much for having me back.
Well, you know, it's a great pleasure.
I enjoy it. Intelligent talk so much, and you're the best.
Well, what do I say after that? How do I top that? By asking you this quite directly. 9/11 changed a lot. It changed, in many ways, our whole definition of the nature of the international order in which we are located. And it introduced the world to a figure lots of us hadn't heard much about or hadn't paid much attention to until then, namely Osama bin Laden. But also, apparently, it called into question our whole security position, our whole security philosophy. Do please, as a way of getting into this fascinating and very important subject, explain the shift in policy, as announced just a few months later in the government paper, essentially saying that the age of deterrence was finished.
Well, up until that time, our enemies were people who didn't want to die, and we could deter them. We could tell them if they attacked us, we would massively retaliate. If the Soviet Union bombed New York, we would bomb Moscow and Leningrad. And if people don't want to die, they take seriously threats of deterrence. But the suicide bombers who destroyed the buildings on 9/11 and killed so many people, if you see their pictures on the video as they were passing through security, the serene look on their faces, they just didn't fear death. They welcomed death. And how do you deter people who welcome death? Well, we could do it if we didn't have any morality. We could threaten to kill their innocent relatives the way the Nazis and Stalin did. It was called Sippenhaft, the punishment of kin. But we can't do that in a civilized society. We can't willfully and deliberately kill innocent people. And so we really can't deter people who are anticipating a payment in a world to come. I mean, if they really believe they're going to paradise and are going to get 72 virgins, I mean, if we could persuade the imams to change the text and argue that they don't get 72 virgins, they just get one 72-year-old virgin, you know, maybe we could have some impact. But seriously, there's no way we're going to deter them by threatening them. So the other alternative is preemption. The other alternative is get them before they get us. We can't deter wild animals, for example. You can't deter lions and tigers. We don't make no effort to threaten them. We don't shake our finger and say, Mr. Lion, if you eat a human being, we will punish you. What we do is we build walls between them and us. Oh, if they're in a city, we kill them. We do whatever it takes. We tranquilize them, but we don't try to reason and deter them. And I think that's the policy that we've been moving toward very quietly since 9/11.
But, Alan, would you credit this as an interpretation of a history that precedes what happened at 9/11?
Sure.
If you go way back to the Nixon administration, we made a decision, and Kissinger pushed this decision, to go from single-headed intercontinental ballistic missiles to multiple warheads, MIRVs, multiply targeted independent reentry vehicle, is what the acronym stood for. Once we did that, the whole calculus of mutual assured destruction was altered, because MIRVs, if they could carry, say, 9 warheads instead of 1, and if they could be well targeted, might destroy 9 missile sites on the other side rather than just one, thus, in essence, giving you the possibility of knocking out the retaliatory capability of the other side.
That's right.
That was the way the strategic theorists thought about it. And there comes a point, I think, this is the stuff that I've worked on in the past and done a little bit of journalism on. There comes a point where on both sides, the strategic theorists are beginning to think like this. Gee, it's possible now that they could steal the march on us and do a preemptive strike,
sure,
which would so limit our retaliatory capability that they might be willing to ride out the limited response we could make, particularly if they're also installing what they take to be some sort of defensive cover against nuclear assault. That being so, they may be considering preemption. Therefore, it might be prudent, particularly when things get hot with some sort of international geopolitical crisis that we get involved in with the Soviets, or they with us, there might come a point where the strategists are saying they may be thinking of preempting us. Therefore, our only alternative is to preempt them. Weren't we actually running, hadn't we upset the delicate balance of terror so that there was a danger that there might be preemption, not against a nation like Iraq or not against the camp of Al-Qaeda someplace in Afghanistan, but one great nation against another?
Yes, and in fact, in my book Preemption, I tell the story about how early on, as early as 1949, there were people in the American government who urged a preemptive strike mm-hmm. against the developing Soviet strength.
Even before they went to MIRV missiles.
Even before they went to MIRV missiles. And then with MIRVs, of course, we revisited that option over and over again. There were thoughts about a preemptive strike on China before it developed its mm-hmm. nuclear weapon, on Pakistan before the Muslim bomb was created. Look, if we had known that Pearl Harbor was going to be subject to attack, and of course there's great controversy about how much we knew, but if we had clear, unequivocal intelligence, clearly the United States would have been justified in destroying the Japanese Air Force before it ever flew a plane to Pearl Harbor. And one of the reasons I call my book Preemption, A Knife That Cuts Both Ways, is if you justify preemption, then you have to justify pre-preemption.
Exactly.
And the cycle becomes very, very difficult to control, which is why in my book I call for a jurisprudence of preemption, when it's appropriate, when it's not appropriate. The United Nations is actually now reconsidering Articles 50 and 51. You know, the UN Charter says you cannot attack another government unless it attacks you first by arms, and which means there's no preemption permitted under the Charter. A recent commission headed up by the former foreign minister of Australia has recommended changing that and saying if an attack is imminent and certain and preemption is the only way to stop it, you needn't go to the United Nations. So that, for example, Israel's attack in 1967 on the Syrian and Egyptian Air Force would have been justified, but Israel's attack on the Osirak reactor in 1981 under this amendment would not be justified because the threat posed by Iraq was not imminent and certain. It was only probable and distant.
Well, in 67, Nasser of Egypt had already closed the Straits of
Tehran. Tehran. But that wouldn't justify it under the Charter because he hadn't engaged in an arm attack. He had engaged in a casus belli.
But he was massing his armies in Sinai on the Israeli border.
Right, and had thrown out the UN peacekeepers. So by any rational calculation, that ought to be permitted. And the United Nations is now agreeing that that ought to be permitted, but not, they're distinguishing, interestingly enough, between preemption on the one hand and prevention on the other. Preemption means imminent and certain, and prevention is what we did in Iraq. We thought they had weapons of mass destruction. We thought if they did, they would pose a threat to us ultimately and a threat to others. Therefore, we engaged in a preventive, not a preemptive war, and even under the amended UN Charter, that would not be permitted.
Now, go back in modern history, say, to World War II, or rather to the 1930s, before World War II.
Right.
Listen to this quotation from Winston Churchill in his book, The Second World War. One day, President Roosevelt told me, he was asking publicly for suggestions about what the war should be called. I said at once, the unnecessary war. I think what Churchill is saying there is we could have got rid of the Nazis long before they started World War II.
He's not the only one who said that. Joseph Goebbels, I quote him in my book, and I also quote Churchill. Goebbels said they were shocked that the British army didn't attack them just before 32. You know, they said they could have stopped us. They could have stopped us in any way, and they never did. And that's why Chamberlain became the poster child, and why the failure to act preventively was a great failure, and why you can't say preventive wars are never justified. I think most people who opposed the war in Iraq, as I myself did, would have favored, had we been alive then, a preventive war against the Nazi buildup. But remember what would have happened if France and Britain would have attacked the German government in 1935. Nobody would now know that we prevented the worst war in history with millions and millions of civilian casualties. All we would know is that England and France aggressively destroyed a weak country with a tin horn dictator who was just recovering from a massive defeat at the end of the First World War.
You know, there's a kind of science fiction story in which you have time travel, and you go back to alter the fate of one particular crucially placed individual. The crucially placed individual in an obvious scenario is Hitler. If you send a time traveler back to 1918 and he tracks Hitler down when he's still a corporal in the German army,
And there's the famous story of that person who had a bead on him and didn't shoot. And, you know, had he shot him and killed him. I mean, who knows, you know, the view of individuals in history. We never know whether if Hitler hadn't done it, Goering or Goebbels or somebody else.
I think you could make
it,
a fair argument. You remember a fellow who recently died. What's his name? He wrote for commentary regularly. Did a famous article a number of years ago, the title of which was No Hitler, No Holocaust.
Yeah, no, I think that's probably right. But if Hitler had been killed, we'd never know what it was we prevented.
Yeah.
And the same thing, I think, is true often with preemptive attacks, or even to take it on a more micro basis. New York now and Texas and other states are thinking about preventive detention of sexual psychopaths, locking them up before they rape. Now, you know, if we lock them up...
How do you know anybody's a sexual psychopath before he's done a psychopathic act?
Well, usually it applies to somebody who's done something but who has served his term and is about to be freed. Say they had some act of pedophilia but not a rape or anything like that, and they've served 2 years or 5 years and they're about to be released, but the psychiatrist says, you know, pedophilia can't really be cured, there's a high rate of recidivism, maybe we should hold him. And if we hold these people, we'll never know what it is we prevented or didn't prevent. We won't know how many false positives we've included, how many false negatives we've prevented. That's the kind of jurisprudence that I think we need to begin to develop in our use of prevention and, you know, and preemption.
Well, you're a lawyer, and so you see the need for jurisprudence. You see the need for a legal code that handles all the contingencies and all the exigencies.
Right.
I'm not a lawyer. Why do we need to be so prissy about law in this regard? As, for example, with regard to bugging people who are in contact via electronic means or via telephonic means with Al-Qaeda or other such agents abroad who look forward to our destruction. Why do we need to be so concerned about all the jot and tittle and fine points of law before we bug them?
Well, remember, you mentioned Nixon before. Every time we think about governmental power, we should have a picture in our mind of Richard Nixon, not of George Bush or even of Dick Cheney, but of Richard Nixon. He had the authority to bug, and remember how he used it. He used it to go after his political enemies. He claimed he was doing it for national security. In fact, he got impeached because the tape showed that he was going to use
The poor fool bugged himself and incriminated himself there.
You know, the one thing we don't know about this administration's policies, we don't know what we don't know. We don't know what else they're doing. They are practically thinking about prosecuting the New York Times for espionage, for printing the story. There's actually a criminal investigation going on now. So what else is there out there that they're doing that we don't know? The one thing about law is you must keep a record. And under our current law, if you have a national security wiretap, you go to FISA, this special court. It's not a particularly demanding court, but at the very least, you have to keep a record. And you have to, there is under oath a statement of why the bugging is occurring. And remember, it was John Kennedy, the liberal John Kennedy, who bugged Martin Luther King because he didn't have to justify it to anybody. And J. Edgar Hoover said, we have to bug Martin Luther King and have some stuff on him. And the Kennedy administration went ahead and did it.
Alan, a direct question. Are you now, or have you ever been, a member of the ACLU?
Oh, boy, I am an active member.
You're still a card-carrying member.
I was a member of the national board. You know, they never gave out cards. I wish they would. But I was a national board member of the ACLU. I got actually bounced off the ACLU national board, or at least not reelected, because I had some doubts about some of the political correctness of the organization, about race quotas, about whether Roe versus Wade was constitutionally mandated. I support a woman's right to choose, but I was never a big fan of constitutionalizing the issue. But I remained on the Massachusetts board, and I'm still an active member, though I dissent from a lot of their views.
And they must dissent from some of yours. What
yes,
I have in mind, for example, is a book you did just within the last few years, in which essentially you say torture might sometimes be justified.
Well, everybody knows that. Everybody knows that if we ever had a ticking bomb that was really about to go off in downtown Chicago and New York, there isn't an FBI agent, a CIA agent, or a policeman who wouldn't do whatever it took to get the information. Now, you know, torture never, rarely, if ever, produces truthful confessions, and that's why it's never used to tell, it's never used to say admit what you did by a rational society. What people do, what they've done in the Philippines and elsewhere, is take us to where the bomb is planted. It has to be self-proving. And of course we would do that. And the debate I tried to start in my book, Why Terrorism Works, was not a debate over whether we should use torture. We would. There's no doubt we would if we ever had a ticking bomb.
And possibly we are already doing so.
Right. But whether we should try to incorporate it within the law or do it outside the law. And I argue that if we're going to do it, and I hope we never have to, but if we're going to do it, we better do it within the law so that, again, there's accountability and there's no deniability, and we don't get led to Abu Ghraib's where everybody says, oh, we had nothing to do with this. It was never authorized. It just happened by accident. And they prosecute people at the bottom of the chain, but not people at the top.
We are already 10 minutes late for our first round of commercials. I'm going to stop for those in just a moment, Alan. And then when we return, I want to play you an excerpt from a program that we did here only last Friday night, which has to do with an encounter in Israel, or rather near Israel, in Gaza. And you'll see why when you listen to it. And it will lead us into a discussion of preemptive dynamics in the Israeli-Palestinian or right. Israeli-Muslim right. world situation.
Right.
We return to Alan Dershowitz as we are drawing from his new book, Preemption, A Knife That Cuts Both Ways. That is, by the way, just published within the last few months by Norton. And we shall resume after these words. And we return to our guest for the evening, Alan M. Dershowitz. This new book, Alan, Preemption, A Knife That Cuts Both Ways, by my measure, is your 20th or your 22nd or thereabouts?
It's my 24th, and it's
24th.
Just literally being published this week. It just is hitting the press. And the thing that surprised me most is it got really wonderful blurbs from people who generally don't agree with me. Richard Posner of the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit, Cass Dunstein from the University of Chicago, Michael Walzer, and General Wesley Clark. So it seems to have hit a very nice note.
It does coordinate with Posner's thought. Posner is a man I know, and he's been on this program a number of times. Yeah. We discussed that earlier book of his, which addressed some of the same questions.
Catastrophe,
Listen, I said I wanted to play a clip for you. Let me say a little bit about this. Only last Friday, I got together with three features writers in town. One of them is Ron Grossman, who's a senior person at the Tribune, former college professor in medieval history, who turned journalist about 20 years ago. And he writes very brilliantly. He's got a strong Jewish identification as well. And he told us a story about something that happened when he was in Israel a number of years ago. And I want you to hear this clip. It runs about 3 minutes, and you'll see why once we play it. Here's Ron Grossman.
One time when I was working out of our Jerusalem bureau, all the heavies were coming to town. Mrs. Albright, and she was going to meet with Bibi Netanyahu and with Yasser Arafat. And you know, it's going to be a parade of limousines and talk of this and talk of that. And again, you're trying to think what to do differently.
So, you're always looking for the angle.
Yeah, exactly. So this was at the time that Hamas was first coming to prominence. So through our interpreter, in the unlovely talk of the trade, a person called a fixer, because they not only go between languages, but they keep you out of trouble, etc. I said, could we go talk to Sheikh Yassin, the founder of Hamas? And for listeners who might not know, Israel is like a super bureaucracy. You put in a request, you do this, you do that, blah, 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 and maybe. He called his cousin, who called his cousin, who called a brother. And within an hour, a message came back. The sheikh would love for you to come at tea time. So we went there. We drove up to Gaza. And he was in a little rundown building with a couple of teenagers sitting on broken kitchen chairs outside with guns on their lap. And you just hoped against hope they didn't decide this was the time to learn how to use the darn thing. And we go in there, and the sheikh is absolutely transparent like a leaf. And his hearing is so bad that there's a long kind of cord that goes up to a thing on his ear, and the interpreter speaks in there. So I said, ask the sheikh to tell us his philosophy. And it comes back, and it wasn't tough to understand. This was not Hegel. This was very, very simply the necessity of his people killing my people. You know? So I said, okay, now tell the sheikh that I'm Jewish. And so it goes back and tell him, so does that mean that from his standpoint, I have to go too? Suddenly, the face lit up with color. And the answer came back, oh, sir, how could you say such a thing? You are a guest in my house. You are always safe here. So I said to the interpreter, tell him again, when the proverbial hits the you-know-what, I'm coming through that door real fast. And he said, there will always be a place for you.
To strike a rather solemn note, they got to him before they got to you.
Yes, this is chronologically true.
He was shot down by an Israeli
missile a couple of years ago. Yeah.
Yeah, part of their punitive action against Hamas.
Yeah.
And, Alan, you understand why I played that for you?
Oh, sure. And, by the way, I don't think Israel would describe it as a punitive action. What happened was Sheikh Yassin was killed a few days after he personally approved the blowing up of gas tanks in Ashkelon, which, had it succeeded, could have killed as many as 10,000 Israelis, Jews and non-Jews alike.
So this was a preemptive action.
It was a preemptive action. And then, of course, he was replaced by a man named Rantisi, who immediately announced that as soon as he was becoming head of Hamas, he was ordering the military wing of Hamas to kill as many Jews as possible, and they bumped him off, too. The United States has done the same thing, you know, sometimes with success, sometimes without. We went after somebody in Yemen with a bomb and killed him, a terrorist, and recently we went after some of the Al-Qaeda people in Pakistan, killed four of them, but also a dozen or so innocent people. And in my book Preemption, I have a whole chapter on targeted killings, and I think they're only to be used as a last resort, only predictively, only to prevent future terrorism, never for punishment.
Well, would you say that all of the Israeli actions against Palestinian activists of that sort have been only in reaction to plans drawn?
No.
Have only been preventive, or have some of them been retributive?
Well, it's so hard to know. If you see the movie Munich, it makes it seem like everything was retributive. But in fact, I know what happened at Munich, because I've written about that extensively as well. And it was only after the Israelis learned that all of the terrorists all through Europe had been freed, and most recently the ones at Munich had been freed as the result of a coordinated hijacking of a Lufthansa airplane, which Willy Brandt was personally involved in arranging so that he could free the last of the three terrorists. And when Golda Meir learned there was not a single terrorist in prison in Europe for hundreds and hundreds of terrorist acts, that Israel decided it had to take the law into its own hand. The only way to protect its civilians was to kill the terrorists before they killed them. And that's when they engaged on what became the events that followed Munich. I'm not saying that Israel has done it right all the time. I am saying that the theory of anticipatory killing, if necessary. Remember, they don't use the killing in the West Bank. In the West Bank, they arrest them because they have troops that can go in.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the Gaza that they've used the targeted killing. And by the way, they've called them off fairly recently when there's been some kind of a truce, except in ticking bomb cases. Most recently, they did kill a guy who was on the way to planting a bomb and another person, but they haven't gone after the commanders now since the truce has been in place.
Now, within the context of our discussion of your new book, Preemption, I want to take advantage of the fact that you're only recently back from Israel.
That's right.
When were you there? How long did you stay this time?
I was there for 2 weeks, and I was invited to speak at the Herzliya conference, in which all the prominent figures in Israel speak. The prime minister spoke, and I met with him for an hour. The foreign minister spoke, I met with her for an hour. The people running against the prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, and Perez, the head of labor, spoke. I did not meet with him. But I got to meet most of the important figures in the Israeli government and to talk to them. I was there during the Hamas election, and I was there after the Hamas election. And I spoke to most of the people following the Hamas election. And so,
now, how are they reacting to the two new threats? Hamas now will be the majority, and indeed just today their man became the prime minister of the PLO, of what presumes to be the Palestinian state. And, of course, we've got crazy Ahmadinejad.
Right, and they're related. They're very closely related.
In Iran.
Remember,
yeah.
Today the head of the Hamas is in Iran meeting with the leaders of the Iranians trying to get financing, and Iran sees this as an opportunity to stick its very, very dangerous nose into the Middle East and to try to internationalize.
All the more so as America, as we've announced, we will no longer fund the Palestinians at all, and we're asking all of our Western allies to do the same.
Right, and it's very, very complex. I mean, Jimmy Carter has a piece in today's Washington Post urging the United States and Israel to continue with support. But of course, when the United States was attacked on 9/11, the first thing we did is we went after all the bank accounts of various terrorist organizations and bank accounts of Afghanistan, even though the money wasn't ours, the money was theirs. But it's traditional when terrorism is at stake, you go after their money. And I think it would be unthinkable for Israel at this point to provide money, whether it's their money or anybody else's money, that could be used to pay suicide bombers. Remember that Hamas pays bounties for suicide bombers, and something has to be done to figure out how to get the money to pay for the humanitarian work that's being done without any possibility that money will be used to foment terrorist attacks against civilians. That's a very complicated problem.
You remember years ago, Abba Ibn said of Arafat, he never misses an opportunity to miss an opportunity.
That's right.
One might say of Jimmy Carter, he never misses an opportunity to get it all wrong.
Well, I think, you know, I was with him in Israel, too. He spoke at the Herzliya conference, and we had an opportunity to speak the day before the election. And he was, I think, optimistic that the elections would go well. I think he was thinking more procedurally, and procedurally, in fact, they did go well. I was invited to go and watch the election, but they told me I had to wear a bulletproof vest, and my wife vetoed that particular activity. I did go to East Jerusalem, but Jimmy Carter is a courageous man. He went into Ramallah, I think, and watched the elections, and the elections went off flawlessly, procedurally, but, you know, they resulted in the election mostly as the result of the ineptitude of the Arafat wing.
Now, what I would really like to know from you is how do you read the reactions of the Israeli governing elite, or for that matter, some of the opposing parties, with regard to these changes in both Palestine and in Iran? Do they feel more deeply threatened now than they did a few months ago?
Oh, I think so. I think there's enormous disappointment on the left and in the center that the peace process has been set back.
Yeah.
There's a lot of joy, by the way, and we told you so, among the hard right in
among
Israel.
The Likudniks.
Yeah, well, Likud, but even to the right of Likud, people, the settlers and others who were saying, see, we told you we can't deal with these people. We told you there's no partner for peace. Why did you pull out of Gaza?
So what are they going to do from Israel? What are they developing as a strategic response at this point? And by the way, is preemptive assault part of the repertoire?
Well, it's not being taken off the table, certainly. And, you know, Israel has made it clear it will not allow Iran to develop a nuclear bomb, whatever it takes. The United States has taken that position, too. I hope it doesn't come to a military attack, but it may have to. I think for the next 5 weeks, nothing is going to happen. Why? There's an election in Israel, and nobody is going to take a chance of being courageous and saying, let's extend an olive branch to Hamas. But I think if Kadima, which is the centrist party that Sharon created and now is headed by Ehud Olmert, who's also an old friend of mine, if he wins the election, which I think he will win the election, I don't take positions on Israeli elections, but I'm making a prediction here because I think the Israeli populace is moving toward the center.
Actually, the polls show that.
The polls show that. If he does win, I think he may take some bold action.
Such as what?
Such as saying, look, you're Hamas, we're extending a peace offer of the kind that was extended previously. Come to the table and negotiate. You will have to give up your claim to destroy Israel, but we are prepared to be quite generous and to end many of the settlements in exchange for you giving up your claim to destroy all of Israel. There may be some offer made. And the alternative is if you don't come to the bargaining table, then Israel will do in the West Bank what it did in Gaza, that is unilaterally withdraw to the point where it chooses to withdraw. And basically that will be the security fence. And whatever is outside the security fence will de facto become the Palestinian state if they choose to declare it. And whatever is inside the security fence will be annexed to Israel. That will be the unilateral approach. If the Palestinians come to the bargaining table, they will get a much more generous approach.
Is it conceivable to you that the Palestinians, i.e. Hamas, the majority and controlling the government, though to be sure the presidency is still held by Fatah, Is it conceivable to you that Hamas would go for this without fearing that it would so discredit itself with the Palestinian populace that it will lose power?
I think they can't do that. I think they can't change their charter and they can't change their position. But remember, they only won a minority of the votes, a plurality. I think the vote was 44% to 42%, the popular vote. But because Fatah messed up so badly and had five, six candidates and run in districts when Hamas had only won, Hamas overwhelmingly won the number of seats. If an election were held tomorrow in the Palestinian Authority, again, it's not clear how it would come out if one person ran against one person in each district. And I think the wisest thing for the United States and Israel to do now would be to let them have their money, their $50 million here and there, and let the Palestinians fight out among themselves and determine over the next 6 months or so, while Israel has its election, whether or not they really want to go the way of resistance and continued warfare, or whether a majority really wants to have a peace process. Jimmy Carter thinks a majority wants to have the peace process. Let that thesis be tested. But if it proves to be wrong, if in fact Hamas won and would continue to win because there is resistance to a two-state solution, then Israel is going to have to act unilaterally.
Alan, again, some commercials and a little bit shorter than the last pause, but let me put something else on the table. I'm just responding to some of the things that are in the news at the moment, and I, like so many others, maybe out of sheer naivete, am rather aghast at the disclosure that a company based in Dubai, representing the United Arab Emirates, will now control, if this is allowed, and this has been approved by the Bush administration, that company, an Arab company, will now control most of the ports, not just seven of them, but about 25 of them, I learned, from Maine all the way down the East Coast, as far as over into the Gulf area, as far as New Orleans. If we're going to be concerned about defending ourselves against a terrorist assault, and if one of the main things that we're supposed to be afraid of is what might be secreted away within the containers on those container ships, which all of those containers then ultimately put on the docks of American cities, I don't know what the hell is going on, frankly. I don't know who's thinking, if thinking at all, in Washington. Perhaps you can shed some light and perhaps you can calm my sense of outrage. We shall see right after we pause for this. Our guest tonight is Alan Dershowitz, Felix Frankfurter Professor of Law at Harvard Law School. His previous books, and there are many of them, include perhaps most recently The Case for Israel, America on Trial, The Case for Peace. And I just had a little fit of indignation, partially staged, but reflecting some real doubts and confusions on my part, about the government's endorsement of, or perhaps even the government's engineering, of a deal in which a Dubai-based firm will now be running the ports of many major American cities. What's going on? If preemption is what you do to get rid of a threat that you could not otherwise prevent, then why aren't we on a preventive basis simply ruling out United Arab Emirate firms from having control of our ports?
Well, the question is really one of, in some respects, profiling. Are we prepared to say that no country which has an Arab majority, which is a Muslim state, should be able to have any of its companies involved in security issues in this country, even if they pass through all the traditional security tests? That would be one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is that this administration has been soft on terrorism when it comes to its friends in the Gulf area, Saudi Arabia and the Arab Emirates, because there's been such a close connection between, you know, Halliburton and the Bush family and this particular...
Now you sound like the partisan Democrat.
I know. I'm saying there are two ways of looking at it. On the one hand, I sounded like a civil libertarian. Let's not profile. On the other hand, I'm looking cynically at these issues. And I don't know what the answer is. I mean, part of me says... I don't want to say that a company should be disqualified simply because it's part of a country that has had a bad record.
Well, I think you might argue for that. I think the argument would be this: let's grant that the officials of and the executives of that company and all of their bureaucracy are totally fine people who would never dream of lending themselves to an assault upon an American city. But they employ lots of others.
Mm-hmm.
Two of the people in the 9/11 assault were from the United Arab Emirates, and they have lots of employees. We've also been told again and again that the greatest weakness we've got with regard to defending against...
I think that's true.
...is these
containers.
These containers on ships. An ordinary employee could possibly sneak in, maybe even a dirty bomb kind of device.
Of course.
Or a chemical device.
But of course, a citizen of Dubai could probably work for an American-owned company, too. The
next
question is, do we want to make sure that no employee who comes from one of these countries should be able to work? We have to ask ourselves what the general policy is. We shouldn't just react by saying, oh my God, this is an Arab country, and therefore we have to forget all about our commitment to...
Well, listen, if they got rid of Chertoff tomorrow and gave the job to you, what position would you then take in advising the president?
I would sure look into it very, very, very hard, but I don't think I would be influenced by the immediate knee-jerk reaction of some politicians who make an automatic equation between ethnicity and disloyalty. I'd be very concerned about that. Remember, I recall, as you do, we remember when 110,000 Japanese Americans were put in concentration camps just because of their ethnicity. Now, I'm not suggesting that that's being done here, too, but as a country, I think we have an understandable allergy toward profiling, which is based on religion or ethnicity, but we do have to be realistic. And, you know, we might have a policy that says no foreigners, period, should ever be able to be able to control our ports, just like we have that policy about no foreigners are allowed to own, I think, radio stations or television stations.
Speaking of prevention, which should precede preemption,
sure. Well,
what about our porous border, particularly the southern border?
There's no question about that, but we also don't want to see terrorism be used as an excuse for preventing immigration of people whose immigration is sought to be prevented, not to on terrorist grounds, but for other economic
if it's illegal immigration?
Well, remember, I don't know about your grandparents, but I wouldn't want to have anybody check
legally
too closely about all of my ancestors. Many very distinguished Americans today come from backgrounds where our family's immigrant status was at least subject to some question, because they came in during a time when it was very tough to come into this country if you came from Eastern Europe or Southern Europe, and if you didn't have Anglo-Saxon blood in your body. So I'm relatively sympathetic to people who want to come to this country to make a better life.
Listen, you're a Borough Park boy,
I am.
It's a neighborhood in Brooklyn, and I'm a Bensonhurst boy from next
door. That explains everything.
And I will remember the old folks around Borough Park, the Orthodox ones particularly.
Right.
Of course, they're there again in large number.
Absolutely. My mother lived there until 2 or 3 years ago. You must have gone to New Utrecht, did you?
Of course I went to New Utrecht.
Right. Yeah.
Where did you go?
I would have gone to New Utrecht, but I went to Yeshiva. My parents wouldn't trust me with an assimilated group. So
But my point is, or rather my query is, are you saying some of those old folks I saw around Borough Park were in this country illegally?
I suspect so. I hope so. I can tell you that my grandfather, who was a great hero in 1938 and 39, he saw Nazism coming, and he filed false affidavits calling for people to be brought into the country because all of the congregations in his neighborhood needed new rabbis and new sextons and new cantors, and he was urging people to build synagogues in the basements of their houses to help bring people out of Europe to save their lives. And I wouldn't, we had no lawyers in the family at the time, but I sure would have had to defend my grandfather had he been charged with some immigration fraud, and I would have done it with great, great pride. I'm very proud of my grandfather for what
he did. We've got a batch of commercials coming again in 2 minutes, so let me just open up an area that interests me a great deal and get a two-minute response from you, and then we'll talk about it some more after we take care of those commercials. Do you think it, as many do think, or at least they say they do, that it is virtually inevitable, whatever virtually means, take out the virtually, that it is inevitable that we will have another major terrorist assault upon this country?
I do. I think tragically it is inevitable, and I think it's also inevitable that Iran probably will get a nuclear weapon. I think it's inevitable that nuclear weapons will probably fall into the hands of some terrorist groups. I think we're living in a very, very dangerous age.
Then the follow-on question, of course, is there anything we can do preemptively, or before that, preventively, to see that to reduce the likelihood that that will happen.
I think so. I think reduce is the proper phrase. I don't think we can eliminate all chances, but I think we can reduce it.
Well, when we return from some coming commercials, let's talk about what we can do to reduce the danger of a major terrorist assault upon this country, which we agree might very well take nuclear or biological or chemical form. It would be far worse than the 3,000 we lost when the planes crashed into the World Trade Center towers. We shall return to conversation with Alan Dershowitz, who is, by the way, talking to us from a radio station in Boston. He's on an ISDN line, so it sounds as if he's in the studio, but we're delighted to get him in any possible way we can. And we will continue right after we pause for this. And we return to Alan Dershowitz, who was talking to us from a studio at WBZ in Boston. I gather that's close to your own home.
It is. It's right across the river from where I live in Cambridge.
Very convenient.
Yeah.
By the way, speaking of Cambridge, a parenthesis, a long one, but you and I chatted about this on the phone earlier this afternoon. Mm-hmm. I've been very bothered by what's been happening at your university, by the Get the President campaign, which seems to be being pushed by some sectors of the university.
That's right.
And they've called a meeting of the arts and sciences faculty, I gather, yet again to test a vote of no confidence against Larry Summers. What the hell is going on?
Well, it's very, very dangerous. What happened is there is a very hard left group on the Faculty of Arts and Sciences that is totally unrepresentative of the faculty of the rest of the university that hates Larry Summers because he committed the cardinal sin of political incorrectness. He made comments that disturbed many about women. He made comments to an African-American professor. He supported the right of ROTC to recruit on campus despite its policies of don't ask, don't tell in regard to gays. And he made a very controversial speech about Israel where he said that some who call for boycott and divestiture only against Israel in a world where there's so much human rights violation may be guilty of anti-Semitism in effect, if not in intent. And those four things led to...
Who are the faculty people who are going after him for all of this?
Well, it's a hard left group on the faculty, many of them in the social sciences, sociology, psychology. But he's very popular at the law school. He's very popular at the business school. He's very popular in the medical school. He's very popular among the students. There was a poll today that's going to be released in tomorrow's Crimson.
Yeah, I read about that.
In which I think 3-1 the students support him very much. So this is a big fight between the radical left on the Faculty of Arts and Sciences and the rest of the university. Now, you know, they also claim that he's had governance problems, but they won't give the guy a break. For example, he appointed a dean. Many on the left didn't like his appointment. Then the dean left. Many of the people didn't like that the dean left. There were a few other issues of governance, but I think the reason, what stimulated this in the beginning, was a right-left argument, and now the corporation apparently has gotten into it. And, you know, none of us knows how Harvard is really ruled. Who are these corporation types? I said in the Crimson today, I've been teaching at Harvard 42 years, and nobody ever taught me the secret handshake. I don't even know how to reach the people in the corporation. And, you know, who makes these decisions?
You know,
I hope he doesn't get forced out, but it's possible.
A long time ago, David Reisman of blessed memory, who was on the faculty at Harvard for a long time.
Great man.
And whom I knew rather well. David Reisman, in his book about higher education in this country, whose title I forget, but it was a very interesting set of essays, says that, well, everything goes from the center to the periphery. Mm-hmm. And so the fashions are set at Harvard, Yale, and Princeton, and maybe University of Chicago, and then they radiate out. If the fashion now is to get the president because he's politically incorrect or makes a slip or two, which is all that Summers did, then maybe they're going to start doing this at Kennebunkport Subnormal 5 years from now.
Well, I think so, and it may also dribble down to faculty members. I mean, you know, if you don't like what the president said about women, and I didn't like what he said about women.
All he said,
by
the way, all he said is that the data showed that there were fewer women who had achieved distinction in certain scientific fields than men. That's true.
And then he said that there are many reasons for it, and the first three or four reasons he gave were perfectly reasonable, that many women choose careers.
Yeah.
But then he also said that
there might be some
inherent.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I think that deserves to be 150th on any list, not fourth on any list, and I told him so. And if you don't agree with what he says, you write about it. I've disagreed with him vociferously about his policies regarding ROTC. I don't think we should allow anybody to come on our campus who discriminates on the basis of sexual preference. But I don't believe in firing a president because you disagree with him. If you disagree with him, write a smarter article.
But you fear that it might get down to faculties. It got down to faculties a long time ago.
It did.
It got down to faculties with regard to the tenure decision.
Yes.
You take junior faculty, and if they lean too far in a conservative direction on certain crucial issues, mm-hmm. very often they will be savaged and kicked out with a cover story that the research that they've done or the publication record right. isn't good enough. I know right. of a number of cases of people of a conservative orientation who really get sent packing from other, I know of one, in fact, just recently, I think, at the University of Chicago, the place where mm-hmm. I've been teaching yeah. for 30 years.
Well, there really is that risk, and it certainly happened in Europe after 1967 and 68, when the hard left took over many of the faculties
yes,
in
exactly.
France and in Germany. It became very, very hard for faculty members who had a somewhat more conservative view to get tenure. Now, I'm on the liberal end of my faculty, but I want to see a diverse faculty. Some of the best people at Harvard, people like Harvey Mansfield and others, are very, very conservative. I don't agree with them, but I very much want to see a faculty that's extremely diverse, and I don't want to see any political litmus test or any political correctness cops walking around and telling people what they can think and what they can say. People forget that the first censure motion against Larry Summers included four reasons, and the four reasons were the ones I've just mentioned, his attitude toward women, gays, blacks, Israel, and...
Well, the attitude towards blacks had to do with one particular
one person,
guy
and,
who...
And,
is Skip more of Gate, a more of a showman than a scholar.
Well, he happens to be somebody I like a lot, but Skip
Gates,
who
was
a very close Cornell West, but
Cornell
Skip Gates, who is a very close friend of Cornell's, they taught together. Skip today announced in the Crimson that the corporation hadn't been to speak to him, and I think Skip supports President Summers, and many African American faculty members support President Summers. So you know, we shouldn't think that the one plurality of one faculty is Harvard. It would be as if, you know, one small part of one faculty at the University of Chicago could determine the governance of that university. That would be a big mistake, but it is possible that the radicals may succeed, and this will become a virus that spreads, I think, to other faculties and
yeah.
will spread to other universities.
Well, one thing that stands against it is an organization that I've been associated with from its founding,
mm-hmm.
namely FIRE,
right.
the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. And FIRE keeps has a staff of lawyers now, and they keep very busy firing shots across the bows of all
They're
sorts
terrific.
Of universities.
They're terrific. Alan Coors and Harvey Silverglade
exactly.
are the two
They're
founders.
The founders.
Are wonderful
you must
people.
Know Harvey quite well. He's
very well. And
based
their book,
in
the you know, the book that they wrote is a terrific, terrific book as well.
But back to what I was setting up a little while ago before we stopped for commercials.
Mm-hmm.
You agree that there's an absolute likelihood that there will be further major assaults upon this country from terrorist sources.
Yes, and I think...
what happens after the next one?
Well, I mean, one of the reasons I'm such a hawk on terrorism is because I'm a civil libertarian. I really believe that if we had another mass casualty attack, particularly one that was biological, which would put the fear of God into so many people, that the first victim would be civil liberties, which is why I think as civil libertarians, we have to do everything in our power to prevent another major terrorist attack, even if it means that we have to think hard about some traditions that we thought were sacred over the years. Take, for example, identity cards, which, you know, America never had identity cards. Britain is now passing a law requiring identity cards, and it may be that we will need to move in that direction, maybe not on a mandatory, but maybe on a voluntary basis. If you want to get through security quickly at an airport or in a public building, you may have to go and have some clearance in advance and get a card that's telemetric, that matches your fingerprint or your retinal print or something like that. And the right of anonymity is no longer something I think that we can afford to recognize in a society. We're not living in Thoreau's world of Walden Pond. People can't have bags over their heads. If you go into a building today, you have to identify yourself. And if you have to identify yourself, it might as well be a foolproof ID system rather than one that is so easy to fake, like the driver's license system we have now. One of the Al-Qaeda manuals that was captured said, go to Virginia and get a driver's license. That's the easiest state to fake your identity and get a driver's license. That shouldn't be so easy to do in the United States.
Well, what do you do about checking the real backgrounds of the people that you hire or the people that you allow into as students into a university or what mm-hmm. have you? What do you do about people who you might have some doubts about, indeed, possibly because of the profile.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there are a number of schools that are going through that problem today. Florida State University hired a professor who was subsequently indicted, and the jury came back with some acquittals and some hung juries, counts on some of them. And Brandeis University now hired somebody, a very distinguished Arabist, who some people are raising questions about. Columbia University has had problems over the years. These are very, very hard questions. You know, DePaul University did something terrible last year. They had a man, a Christian professor, who stood up to some Muslim students and argued with them, and he got fired.
And the argument wasn't even in a classroom.
Wasn't even in the classroom. It was at some fair of some kind.
Exactly.
And the school's reaction was not develop a thick skin the way students should if you're going to get into a confrontation over a divisive issue like the Middle East, but, oh, we're so sorry that a professor offended you. I mean, professors are supposed to be somewhat confrontational with students.
They were clamoring against Israel at their little booth. They were Palestinians, or people of Palestinian origin.
Right.
And Professor Klocek, that's his name, argued with them, as one might fall into natural and normal argument with people you disagree with. And they went to the deans or something, or a deanlet, and said he hurt our feelings.
Yeah, he hurt our feelings. And, you know, the answer in many universities today is you go crying to mommy and daddy, dean or president, and say, my God, our skin is thin, and we had our feelings hurt, instead of fighting back. I mean, the one thing a professor should never be allowed to do is prevent students from expressing contrary views in the classroom. There was a professor at Columbia a couple of years ago who stopped a student in the mid-sentence and said, unless you're willing to acknowledge publicly in this class that Israel engages in atrocities and genocide, I don't want you in this classroom. Well, no, that's not appropriate. You can't condition being in the class or condition grades on a student accepting your viewpoint, but arguing back with a student, my God, that's all we do in law school. I mean, it's not quite paper chase, but no student gets away in my class with saying something, even if I agree with it, especially if I agree with it, without being challenged for the basis of their views. That's what they have to do in court. They better be able to do that in the classroom as well.
Back to the issue I was pushing a moment ago. If there is a major assault and it works, despite all of our preventive efforts, that will transform our society, I think.
I think it
far
will.
More than it has already been affected by the post 9/11 consequences.
Right. And in fact, we have been transformed far less than some other countries. Britain has overreacted to a much greater extent than we have.
Those subway bombings?
Yeah, the subway bombings. They are in the process of passing a law now making it a crime to glorify terrorism. I mean, in this country, we have glorification of terrorism all the time.
At the same time, they're trying to pass a law. Blair pushed this one, but it was rejected by the House of Lords of all bodies, making it illegal to criticize any religion.
Right. And, you know, again, this
that's yielding to Islam, I would
ridiculous
say.
Reaction to these cartoons. I don't know how many of your viewers have seen the cartoons, but they are so mild. They are so
tame. Yes, they are indeed. I've seen them.
Compared to what you can get on memory.com, which tracks Muslim and Arab cartoons that appear in state-sponsored publications.
And which defame Christians and Jews.
And Jews and Americans. And the most horrible forms of anti-Semitism and anti-Christianity, and that's acceptable by state-sponsored newspapers, and yet poor Denmark, it has no law permitting it to censor newspapers, and suddenly you can't buy Danish pastry. It's now Mohammed Rose of Mohammed pastry.
Yes,
and how many people, 15 people maybe or more, have been killed in this cartoon war? I mean, this is very, very frightening.
It hasn't ended. Riots were going on even today.
Yeah, yeah.
But indeed, I spoke with you about this earlier today. There's some interesting articles by a fellow named Mark Stein, whose work I
read them, yeah.
Did you read them?
I
sent them over to you. Well, what'd you think about that? He's talking about the Islamification of Western Europe.
Well, he makes a very interesting point. I'd never heard it before. He makes the point that societies survive based on their birth rate, about how many young people there are in societies. And if you look at diminishing birth rates among Western countries, including, you know, Great Britain, most of Western Europe, the United States, and Israel, and compare it with greatly increasing birth rates among Muslim countries.
Not only in Muslim countries, but among Muslim Muslim residents of Western European
countries.
Also.
I mean, yeah, that's one of his major points. I mean, he predicts in an apocalyptic prediction that by the end of this century, essentially Western civilization will have again been defeated by the Moors.
Oh, sooner than that, by the year 2050 for some of those countries.
Yeah, well, neither of us will be alive to experience that. But and what he does is he then uses it as an argument against abortion and against a kind of feminism, and he chides those feminists who urge increasing use of abortion and increasing reduction in the number of babies born in Western societies. And you know, it's hard to know whether he's right or wrong, but it's certainly a provocative point of view. But what do you do about it? I mean, how do you tell people to go and have more babies? You can't legislate it.
Apart from that, what do you do about larger and larger enclaves of Islamic citizens or immigrants whose kids become citizens by virtue of their birth in this country or their birth in England or France or wherever? What do you do about there being essentially a larger and expanding enclave of anti-Western ideology and anti-Western intention? How do you work an assimilation process so that they, like other immigrants, in this country, for example, become Americans?
Well, it's interesting because in this country we haven't had riots
based
on the cartoons, and I think that's a good thing, and it really shows that we have done more to integrate and assimilate different populations, including Muslim populations in this country. I know I see how well assimilated Muslim students are at Harvard University, you know, there's a lot of close relationship between Muslim students and Israeli students and Jewish students, and it really has worked very, very well at Harvard.
So what's the difference? It's working better in this country than it is in England or France. What's the nature of the difference?
Well, I think several things. First, we're a country of immigrants, and there's no such thing as a real American. The newest American is as real as the daughter of the American Revolution. We have a tradition of assimilation and of we also, you know, have a better employment record for immigrants than some other countries do. We also are seeing in this country there's been more of a breakdown of old ethnic neighborhoods. There are still some ethnic neighborhoods. Obviously, Dearborn, Michigan is largely these days an Arab a city with large enclaves. And there are parts of New York, in fact, parts of where we, not far from where we grew up. I think integration is much more of an American tradition than it is in Europe or France. But
in Brooklyn, you're talking about the Atlantic Avenue corridor,
right?
Which is an Arab locale.
Very much so. And you go there, and it's beautiful to see people wearing Arab garb and integrating very nicely with Hasidim and others. But what's happening, too, is we're going to see an increase in right-wing rhetoric in Europe. We're already seeing it in Italy, that there are politicians who are running on an anti-Islamic and anti-immigration platform. You know, as a Jew, I worry, because the Jew has always been caught between the black and the red. We don't like the right, and we don't like the left. I mean, the hard left has been very bad to us, and the hard right has been very bad to us. We are basically a centrist people, and I get very worried when I see Europe moving more to the left and right at the same time and away from the
center. Well, I don't know that we're a centrist people. I myself welcome the presence of some very bright young Jewish guys in the ranks of the so-called neoconservatives.
Well, so do I. But even the neoconservatives are centrist. I'm talking about the
compared
hard
to the
right,
ones who call themselves paleoconservatives.
Right. The Pat Buchanans on the left, on the right, and the Noam Chomskys on the left. I mean, those people are not good for America. They're not good for any group in America, I believe. And I think that one of the reasons we thrived in America is we have generally had a broad center. But we've never had a Nazi party in this country. We've never had a successful communist party in this country. We're one of the few westernized countries that has never been plagued by real extremism. No, of course, we had racism in the South, and that was terrible. But we've never had the right and the left being active politically. Partly our political system doesn't encourage it because it's winner-take-all elections, and the way we've structured our elections make it hard for small minorities to become kingmakers the way they can in other parts of the world.
Alan, one line of yours that I've been quoting for years, it comes from one of your books, maybe from Chutzpah, maybe from an earlier one, is this, speaking of Jews and of Christians, they used to want to kill us, now they want to marry us. Is that still true?
Well, you know, yeah. I mean, I say to my audiences often, you know, people praise my generation because we didn't marry other, we married Jews. Well, of course we married Jews. Nobody else wanted to marry us. Today, everybody wants to marry us except apparently other Jews.
But this is really a way of getting to the question of what, right. How do you feel about the feasibility of a continuing Jewish identity in the United States?
Well, I think it's going to continue, but it's going to be different. I mean, I think of my grandchildren, to get personal for a second. My son, who was obviously Jewish, is married to a woman who comes from an Irish Catholic background. They describe their marriage as interfaithless because neither of them is particularly religious. But my grandchildren are named Dershowitz, and they live in New York City, and they go to a school that has lots of Jews in it, and they identify as Jews, even though they're not, according to Jewish religious tradition, necessarily Jews. And there can be more and more people like that in America, people of Jewish heritage, like there are people of Irish heritage and people of German heritage. I mean, Judaism is a civilization in addition to being a religion, and I think we're going to see a different kind of Jewish identity in America. Remember, too, that within the next 10 years, America is going to be the second largest population of Jews in the world. We now have the largest group of Jews anywhere in the world living in America, but we're going to be second to Israel soon, and the future of Jewish identity is going to be increasingly lived out and played out in Israel, not in the United States.
Now, listen, old friend, again, I'm running quite late for commercials, but I want, and we're going to go to the phones right after a group of commercials. We're opening the lines right now, the number 591-7200, 591-7200, 312, the area code, if you're calling long distance. If you want to reach us on the internet, rather on email, if you're listening on the internet, any place in the world, the email address is extension720@tribune.com, extension720@tribune.com, or 591-7200. But I want to ask you to do one thing before we, all of our lines I see are taken already, one thing before we stop for those commercials, and simply basically this. This is a fine and important new book of yours, Preemption, A Knife That Cuts Both Ways. We've talked about it, but we haven't given it as much attention as I would otherwise like to give it. Let me ask you, as Hillel said, while standing on one leg, give the essential message of this book.
Preemption is coming. It is a major development that is occurring all through the world. It's occurring medically. It's occurring in the criminal justice system. It's occurring in our foreign policy. It's occurring on a macro level, on a micro level. But it's happening in an ad hoc way. And nobody has sat down and systematically thought about how to create a morality and a jurisprudence. We know that when we punish people, better 10 guilty go free than one innocent be wrongly convicted. But when it comes to preventing people, how many people are we prepared to, for example, keep out of the country or lock up in preventive detention or give an inoculation of a disease against the disease for, in order to prevent how many kinds of terrible acts of what degree? It's that kind of jurisprudence that I think we have to move toward, and I hope my book Preemption, A Knife That Cuts Both Ways, begins the debate. Cass Sunstein says that Dershowitz is right to call for a jurisprudence of preemption. He takes important steps toward providing that jurisprudence. That's my goal, to try to get a debate going.
And it is a very effective reading. It's punchy and strongly argued and has tremendous lucidity.
Thank you.
And is richly illustrated by anecdote and by historical material, which makes all of this all the more relevant and all the more readable. We will pause for a quick round of messages, then right on to your calls and or emails to Alan Dershowitz after these words. We have been talking for the last hour and a half, and we'll continue for the next half hour with Alan M. Dershowitz, drawing from his new book, Preemption, A Knife That Cuts Both Ways. Norton are the publishers of that book. 591-7200 is our phone number. One line is available at this moment. And here is the first caller. Good evening. Hello, are you there?
Yes, hello?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Dr. Milt and your distinguished guest, I was curious about what you said a couple breaks ago, very quickly, about how you thought that they would have another terrorist attack on the United States. Well, my question is, do you believe that it's going to happen from terrorist groups, or will it just be, will it, the terrorist groups be funded by the political people that are in power, like Iran, so forth? Or do you think it would just be a random attack?
I don't think
and secondly, I would like to ask a question real quickly. As much as I would like to support the minorities in the United States, and I look at what's going on around us with the rap music and so forth, and the way the culture is going, you touched on this earlier, can we support what's going on with that type of activity?
Well, remember who the primary consumers of rap music in the United States are. They're middle-class white kids in suburban areas. So, you know, a cultural phenomenon. But as far as the terrorism, most terrorism is state-sponsored. It's very hard for a terrorist group to just organize by itself. We know that bin Laden needed the support of the Taliban and the Afghan government. We know that Iran today sponsors Hezbollah, Islamic Jihad, and probably soon will be sponsoring Hamas. And the great fear is when Iran gets their paws on these things, it internationalizes terrorism and takes it beyond the borders of any one country. So I think state-sponsored terrorism is going to be a very, very dangerous phenomenon.
Are we to assume, Alan, that Al-Qaeda still has a state backing? And if so, from what state?
No, I think that we have destroyed the state, the government
that
supported Al-Qaeda. I think that.
But isn't there something suspicious still about Saudi Arabia?
Yes, I was just going to say the Wahhabi groups within Saudi Arabia, there are many that still are very, very supportive. And I think that there are other countries that subtly support terrorism. You know, the worst supporter of terrorism over the years, of course, was the Soviet Union. And with the disbanding of the Soviet Union, one would have thought that ended. But now that Putin has said he's going to meet with Hamas, it sounds like some of the bad old habits of the Russian bear are coming out again. And remember, too, that France and Pakistan, in their own way, the worst man in the world today, if there were a Nobel War Prize, like there's a Nobel Peace Prize, would go to this character from Pakistan named Dr. Khan, who exported nuclear technology to Iran and maybe to terrorist groups and maybe to some other groups in North Korea. And he's probably today the most villainous man on the face of the earth, and he's living the life of a hero in Pakistan today. So I think you can't separate the state from terrorist activity.
Yeah. Even in Pakistan, which is allied with us, we know that their intelligence service is quite ambivalent.
Yes.
We go back to the phones. Here's the next caller. Good evening.
Yes. Shouldn't we think of prevention in terms of changing the attitudes of young children in the United States attending Muslim-run schools, those that they go to after public school every day?
It's a very, very serious problem. I know that we certainly know that in the Palestinian Authority, particularly in the Gaza and in parts of Saudi Arabia, the kind of hatred that's preached is just appalling. Again, go to memory.com and you'll see a lot of the sermons that are literally produced there. I don't think we've quite had that problem in this country because our schools still have to pass muster with state educational services. And I know there have been some studies. There was one done in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. a few years ago, and there was an article, I think it was in the Washington Post, which described a day in the afternoon schooling of some of these religious schools. And they are a source of concern. And, you know, any kind of education which preaches hatred is clearly not something that's part of the American tradition, and we should look into it.
Our thanks to the caller. I've now got to do some brutal stuff. I've got to catch up with the commercial schedule, and so we're going to stop right now, Alan, and back in about 3 minutes.
Sure.
And back to our audience, I say, back to your calls to Alan Dershowitz. One line is available, and, of course, there's lots of room available on the email roster. If you want to reach us by email, that's extension 720 at tribune.com. By phone, 591-7200. And directly back to Alan Dershowitz, who joins us tonight from Boston. He is the author, most recently, of a fine and important new book, Preemption, A Knife That Cuts Both Ways. And it is an extended argument for the development of a jurisprudence of preemption. But that needn't deter you from getting the book. It is closely argued and vividly written and eminently readable and important for any intelligent reader, I would say. You don't have to be a lawyer, in other words. Just as, you remember the old campaign, Alan? You don't have to be Jewish to enjoy Levy's rye bread.
I remember that very well. Now, this book is actually written for non-lawyers.
Surely.
It really deals with the morality of when it's appropriate to get them before they get us. And it's something that I think affects every American, ultimately.
That's just what preemption is, getting them before they get you.
Yeah.
591-7200 is our number. Here's the next caller. Good evening.
Good evening. Foreign-based terrorism scares me, but I'm also concerned about the militia-based terrorism, such as the Oklahoma City bombing and the Atlantic Olympic bombing. Is that probably... To put it bluntly, is that problem solved, or have they just gone underground?
I don't think it's solved. I think there are haters in this country that would like to emulate what happened at Oklahoma City. There are still websites on which the killers are glorified.
And in which they spout anti-black and anti-Semitic verbiage and vilification
and constantly. And some anti-Catholic as well.
Yeah.
And the hate that goes out of there is amazing. And some of these books, you know, some of the best sellers that have come out about the Turner Diaries and other things of that kind, you know, fortunately, I think our intelligence services have worked pretty efficiently to bottle up the domestic terrorists. But remember that the second worst terrorist attack in American history did come from a native-born former military person who thought he was following in the footsteps of Thomas Jefferson. So homegrown terrorism, it continues to be a real threat.
Thank you very much.
We thank you, sir, for the call. I have an email here, which can be cleared up in just a moment. This listener asks, please clarify the site where the guest noted cartoons from Arab Media. Memory.com, question mark. It's M-E-M-R-I.
Right.
What does that stand for?
M-E-M-R-I. Middle... I don't know.
And it's .org, not .com. M-E-M-R-I.org.
Oh, I'm sorry.
The first two letters are Middle East.
Right.
And the they monitor, essentially, Arab propaganda and Arab...
And they translate it.
Yeah.
And because a lot of it is people like Arafat, who used to speak out of both sides of his mouth. He'd speak peacefully in English and then very, very... warlike in Arabic, and they do a terrific job in translating and picking up by shortwave radio and other means the actual communications and tech. They go through textbooks and they go through newspapers, and they do a great job. I'm sorry I said .com, it's .org.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right.
But we've talked on and off about academic life and about Harvard, but there's a great deal of trouble in the American Academy all over the country, as far as I'm concerned. How do you account for the fact that so much of the American Academy, in the humanities at least, and the social sciences, is essentially pro-Palestinian and anti-Israel, as if you've got to make that binary choice, and they opt for Palestine against Israel?
Well, it's an absurd choice. Whenever I speak on college campuses, I start by saying I'm pro-Palestinian. I favor a two-state solution. I've always been against the occupation. I want to see a successful, democratic, economically viable Palestinian state. I am more pro-Palestinian, I think, than Yasser Arafat was. I didn't steal $3 billion from the Palestinian people. He did. I didn't send out people to commit suicide bombings. He did, and Hamas did. I want to see a successful Palestinian state. The vast majority of people who identify themselves as pro-Israel in this country, particularly on campuses, are also pro-Palestinian. But the vast majority of people who start out by saying we're pro-Palestinian really end up being anti-Israel. In fact, there was a book written to try to contradict my book, and it wasn't called The Case for Palestine. It was called The Case Against Israel, written by some Canadian guy named Newman or something like that. But The Case Against Israel. So it's all about Israel. And in fact, if the Palestinians weren't fighting Israel, nobody would care about them. They'd be the Kurds. They'd be the Chechens. It's only that they're fighting Israel, which causes so much antagonism and creates so much focus on college campuses. College students today don't seem to care about the occupation of Tibet by China. In fact, they favor all kind of support for China, but they want to divest from Israel. You hear very little about what's going on in North Korea or other countries in the world, which are tyrannical.
Yeah.
But on college campuses, Israel is purported to be the worst human rights offender
in the
world.
And the students get that from many of their professors, I fear. What's wrong with the professoriate with regard to Israel? How did this happen?
Well, I would, if you have to have a two-word answer, it would have to be Noam Chomsky. He is the most influential academic in the world today, and he is virulently anti-Israel. I debated him at the Harvard Kennedy School a few weeks ago.
You can read the debate.
It's on the Kennedy School
I read it just today,
website.
Yeah.
And I started by offering him, I said, look, if Shimon Peres, and this was while Sharon was still well, if Shimon Peres and Sharon could join together in the same party in an effort to make peace, the two elder statesmen of Israel, maybe the two elder statesmen of the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians on American academic campuses, namely Chomsky and Dershowitz, can get together. And I offered an olive branch, and I extended my hand, and I said, I will try to move pro-Israel people more to the center into the peace camp, and you try to move the anti-Israel people more to the center and more to the peace camp. And he just rejected it out of hand. And I think he has an enormous following on many college campuses, and the virulent hatred of Israel is just not to be believed. It has no relationship to reality. You know, you can be critical of Israel, I am, of its policies, but to call it genocidal and to talk about, you know, the worst human rights offender in the world, when in fact it has one of the best records of human rights compliance. The villains are also some of the human rights organizations. Amnesty International, you wouldn't believe this, had, you can get it on their website, had an analysis of rapes in the Palestinian Authority and honor killings. You know, Palestinians rape each other and then kill the rape victim. And who did Amnesty blame it on? Israel. And
how did they manage to do that?
Well, the occupation causes men to be under trauma, and then they rape their women. It was an abuse excuse. Human Rights Watch has devoted more time and more energy and more pages to Israel than to the worst human rights offenders. And then people cite these organizations as if the citing of these organizations proves anything other than the bias of the organizations themselves. And so, you know, human rights has become human lefts in many parts of this country. You don't get any concern about human rights of leftist countries, only the human rights
are
of people who are allied with the United States.
Alan, are you sometimes tempted to go along with those who say, probably too simply, the reason they're so anti-Israel is that they're still vestigially anti-Semitic?
Well, I would think that there's some truth for that in some parts of Europe. These are the grandchildren of Hitler's collaborators, many of whom are saying, see, you know, we felt guilty about killing so many Jews, but you guys are just as bad as we were. And that's a rationalization for some of them. But that doesn't explain the United States, where many of the leading opponents of Israel are Jews, like Noam Chomsky.
Yeah.
I think that Sartre and Freud are more appropriate to answering that than I am as a legal and political analyst. I can tell you this, that the way they describe Israel bears absolutely no relationship to the reality. And by the way, ask Palestinians and they'll tell you that the kind of extreme descriptions of genocide and this and that just bears no relationship to what's going on. There are controversies and there are things that Israel does wrong and should be criticized for, but the extremes of the debate on college campuses, lack of nuance, doesn't contribute to resolving these issues.
Sometimes I reflect on the fact that recent DNA studies have demonstrated, particularly by analyzing mitochondrial DNA, that the group in all the world that the Jews are most closely linked to in terms of common ancestry are the Arabs.
Right, and Palestinians are so close to Israelis in so many different ways. They are, at least they were until this most recent election, among the most secular and intellectual educated. And I had great hopes, still have great hopes, that these two countries can work together to see a peaceful resolution, but the Hamas election certainly doesn't bode well.
Well, we must maintain the hope next year in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And we return right after our last round of commercial messages. We made mention a little while ago on this program, in conversation with Alan Dershowitz, of an article by Mark Stein, the one titled, It's the Demography Stupid, which we featured on our blog last week, the blog which you get to by simply going to miltsfile.com. And today we've just put up a new batch of our linked articles, and two of them are, again, by Mark Stein. One of them is about the Muslimization of Europe as viewed from Australia. The other is about, I'll read the entry on the other. Stein was on a roll last week and rounded it out yesterday with this Chicago Sun-Times commentary about Danish pastries, the McDonald's in Lahore, and the idiot in the White House press room. 591-7200 is our number, and we go directly back to the phones, and you are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening, sir. Mr. Dershowitz.
Hi.
Hi, sir. I'm one of your admirers.
Thank you.
Seen you many times on TV. You're a champion of freedom for the centrists, you know, being a member of the ACLU. Mm-hmm. But my question to you, sir, how do you said, you know, that we are going to be attacked by the Al-Qaeda? Al-Qaeda is destroyed by us now. They are running away in the mountains. How can an entity like Bin Laden or whatever his second in command is, they don't have an army. They don't have anything now. No infrastructure. They have lost the only country that they had power in vis-a-vis Afghanistan.
Well, I hope you're right. I hope you're right. But look what they apparently did in Madrid. Look what they apparently did in London. And even when they're on the run, all it takes is six or seven people and an order from somebody running away in a cave or without even his authorization. Their policy has been to wait until they can organize a major attack. And what I fear, you know, it may not be this year, it may not be this decade, but the availability of germ warfare, which can be manufactured quite easily now, mm-hmm. the availability of potentially nuclear weapons. Remember, there was a tape recently released of Saddam Hussein
talking
about how a bomb could easily be put in the trunk of a car and blown up. I think that we certainly can't lower our guard. I hope you're right. You know, it may be that we've destroyed the infrastructure of Al-Qaeda, but we can't reduce our guard.
Why aren't we going after Osama bin Laden, bring that rascal to justice, hang him?
It's not easy to find. Even a 6 foot, whatever it is, tall guy is not so easy to find. I mean, he's hiding. He's actually being hidden, obviously, by supporters in Pakistan or in Afghanistan. These are rugged areas.
Yeah,
and remember how long the guy Rudolph in this country hid.
So
it's not surprising that somebody can hide away for so long.
I agree with you, sir. My second question to you, sir, is who created Hamas? Don't you think it was created by Israel against Al-Fatah?
No, it was created by the Muslim Brotherhoods in Egypt, and the same people that assassinated Sadat. The origins are not clear, but surely Israel had nothing to do with it. It's a sworn enemy of Israel, and Israel has done much to destroy its leadership.
Like, it's just like, you know, if you recall Indira Gandhi's assassination, she created Bindarwal, the Sikh leader, and when he turned against her, she killed him.
Well, there are always these conspiracy theories, and one never knows how intelligence agencies operate when they're not in, they're not being controlled. I mean, the one great thing about our country is we have a commander-in-chief, and the commander-in-chief is the elected president of the United States. And in other countries in the world, the intelligence agencies sometimes operate quite independently of elected government officials, so that's how these conspiracy theories emerge. But I'm certainly convinced that Israel has done everything in its power to eliminate Hamas, and now it has to decide how to deal with the first elected Islamicist radical terrorist group in modern history. Algeria came close to doing that, but obviously other means we use to prevent the Islamicists from coming to power. And now this is the thing that's going to happen in the future. I think we may see it happening not only in the West Bank, but it may cross over to Jordan in the years to come. I think if I were the two people who I think lost the most sleep the night after the Hamas election were King Abdullah of Jordan and Mubarak of Egypt. I think they have to be much more worried about the growth of radical Islamic terrorist organizations within their countries.
Alan, we only have about 3 minutes left, I guess. You just made mention of the commander, our commander-in-chief. Mm-hmm. You are, of course, basically a Democrat by mm-hmm. conviction and by identification, and you're liberal in many of your sentiments, but obviously mm-hmm. in a differentiated and highly personalized way. Mm-hmm. Could we end tonight by my asking you quite simply and directly, overall, what is your estimation of the Bush regime and where it is? Succeeded where it has failed, well, and where it's going.
Last year, I wrote a letter to George Bush after his State of the Union message in which I said, you know, I'm a Democrat and I worked very hard for your defeat. I think I succeeded in 2000, but the courts undid that for us. And when I decided to watch the State of the Union, I thought I'd end up throwing things at the television. And I continue to disagree with you. I wrote on issues of church and state and on issues of civil liberties, but on bringing democracy to the Arab world, I agree with you, and I think that Sharansky makes a good point, and I thank you for quoting Sharansky. And I got a handwritten letter back a couple of weeks later from the president saying, yes, we'll continue to disagree on these things, but he appreciates my support for his democratization program as long as the democratization program is done by peaceful means. So for me, it's a very, very mixed picture. I think many, many good opportunities have been lost. I was against the war in Iraq, and I was against it for three reasons. One, radical Islamization, which I think is happening. Second, diverting attention from the real problem in Iran. I think we've become a paper tiger with regard to Iran because we've devoted so much energy to Iraq. And third, the law of unintended consequences. We just don't know what happens when we do this kind of thing and the enormous numbers of casualties that have been produced. So, on balance, I remain a Democrat and remain critical of the Bush administration.
But you acknowledge that something has been changed for the better in the Middle East through the Iraq War, I gather.
Well, certainly Libya has shown improvement, and certainly Syria has been weakened. It's a work in progress.
And Iraq has been. And wouldn't you say that Iraq has been
improved?
Yes,
and I have some, well, we hope. You know, there's been a radicalization. I would much prefer to confront an enemy who's secular than an enemy who's religious, mm-hmm. because secular enemies are fear death, and we have a great ability to bring death about, but people who welcome death are a very, very hard enemy to deal with, which is why, getting back to the title of my book, preemption is becoming increasingly important when we're fighting a culture of death, a culture that welcomes death and welcomes reward in a world to come. We haven't figured out how to do that yet, and preemption is the wave of the future, so we better start thinking about it.
Excellently said, and I thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
And I look forward to another contact fairly soon.
I hope so. Thank
you. Good night for now.
Good night.